The following program is made possible by a grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
3 days from now, after half a century in the service of our country, I shall lay down the responsibilities of office as, in traditional and solemn ceremony, the authority of the presidency is vested in my successor. So in this, my last good night to you as your president, I thank you for the many opportunities you have given me for public service in war and in peace. I trust in that service you find some things worthy. As for the rest of it, I know you will find ways to improve performance in the future. You and I, my fellow citizens, need to be strong in our faith that all nations under God will reach the goal of peace with justice. May we be ever unswerving in devotion to principle, confident but humble with power, diligent in pursuit of the nation's great goals. Now, on Friday noon, I am to become a private citizen. I am proud to do so. I look forward to it.
Eisenhower Years, a chronicle in sound of the life of Dwight Eisenhower, produced by Extension Radio Television at Kansas State University. This week, Peace with Honor.
This is the final program in our series. In it, we hope to offer some assessment of Dwight Eisenhower as a president and general, but more to offer a further view of Ike the Man. The voices you will hear will be those of the people interviewed for this series, the voices you've been hearing, people who knew and worked with Dwight Eisenhower. It's by no means an objective sample. It amounts only to a handful of his friends and colleagues, but their views offer, I hope, a deeper insight into our 34th president. Most scholars tell us it's still too early to judge the greatness of Eisenhower as a president. Ike himself said his greatest accomplishment in the White House was keeping the peace for that period, and his greatest disappointment that he was unable to create a lasting peace. Some views of the 34th president now. Our sampling includes two journalists, a former Eisenhower presidential aide and writer, a politician from the opposition party. First, former White House aide Arthur Larson.
He had a tremendous intellectual grasp of the problems of the time, and I don't think it really is much help to play around with words like great. They are loaded words. They don't mean much, especially in political conventions where the word great occurs every fourth word. I think the important thing is that he did the job he set out to do, which was to keep the peace for 8 years. I think we have to learn in the era we're heading into, or that we've been going through, how to judge presidents on peacetime achievement. Because so often in the past, it's become habitual to think of the great presidents as the war presidents. Lincoln, Wilson, Roosevelt, and so on. And it's much harder to set standards by which you judge a president's ability to see that we don't get into war, because it's a sort of a negative achievement. And I think when we get the sophistication to do that, the general estimate of Eisenhower will go sharply up.
Author and biographer Kenneth S. Davis.
The thing that was wrong with his presidency, from my point of view, was that there were 8 years there where power should have been exercised, when great opportunities for doing things were presented to him in the world. Stalin died. There was a shift of the balance of power in the Far East. There was on the home front, there was the rise of the civil rights movement. There were all sorts of decisions that should have been made, and a man who had the power, and he had it by virtue of his office, should have exercised it. The refusal of a greatness, I would say, was his tragedy, if you can call it a tragedy.
Former Vice President Hubert Humphrey.
I think that the contribution first of the Eisenhower administration was that it brought some sense of sanity and decency to the American political scene. It also it brought a continuity of foreign policy, which was important in those critical years of the 50s. Very, very important to continue and to indeed to energize NATO. It did bring, of course, with Mr. Dulles, certain features of foreign policy that some of us didn't care for too much, particularly the so-called brinkmanship. But most of that was rhetoric rather than actual policy. And when the chips were down, Eisenhower came down reasonably right. What it did not bring to us, I think, however, was a sense of direction and leadership on the crucial social problems that were affecting the country. The problems of the cities were with us in the 50s. The problems of race were with us in the 50s. And I've always felt that the president could have done much more after the Supreme Court decision of 1954. Had he put the weight of his personal prestige and his personal magnetism and popularity on the side of that decision rather than just kind of leaving it in the nebulous atmosphere of the law, I think it would have changed much of the race problem, much of the race relationship in the country under good auspices. See, what President Eisenhower had to offer was, as I said in the beginning, this warmth, this affection, this trust.
Syndicated columnist Roscoe Drummond.
He will not go down as a great president, but Eisenhower will go down, I believe, in history as a man required at the time, because I think that he rescued the party, the Republican Party, from its perilous historic isolationism and brought it into the post-war world of America's responsibility. I think that was one of his great contributions. Eisenhower lived through a very fortunate period from his standpoint, too. It was a period of quiet times. It was a lull between the storm of World War II and the crystallization of post-World War II foreign policy, which was really brought into being and almost largely carried out by President Truman, and the subsequent domestic storms in of the 1960s. The trouble wasn't there. He didn't have to avoid it because it didn't exist in the terms that we are thinking about trouble today. I think sometimes it's often overlooked, however, that in the early years of the Eisenhower administration, that Eisenhower carried through a set of significant expansions of social welfare, which had not been undertaken since the New Deal. Truman couldn't get it in the Republican Congress of 47-48, and he couldn't get it out of the Democratic Congress that took its place from 48 to 52. And it was only in the first two or three years of the Eisenhower administration that Social Security was expanded, covering more people and other welfare measures. So that the idea that the Eisenhower administration was wholly a businessman's administration, I think, is untrue.
He was not what we needed at the time. It was right after a war, and people did want to have relaxation, and he was a soothing father image. There's no doubt about that. So he did give the American people what they wanted in the way of a soothing syrup. But what the people want is not necessarily what the people need, and this was not a time, it seemed to me, when we could stand still. It just seemed to me we had to... The one of the effects of every war, and certainly World War II, was a terrific... acceleration of technology, which is breeding problems like crazy. These problems were accelerating during this period, and while they didn't look like they weren't political problems, they should have been political problems. They should have been realized at the time that we're going to have to get control of our technology or it's going to overwhelm us. Now it practically has overwhelmed us. We can't control anything, and the chances to control it were much better from 52 to 60 than they are now. Every year it gets tougher.
Ike never had to take a Gallup poll. He was a walking Gallup poll. You know, his instinct was with the country as a whole. Yes, I think he was an expression of the times, and I think he was perhaps a needed transition between the end of World War II and the beginning of domestic wars in 1960.
The failure to really to pick up the mantle after the Korean War and utilize federal revenues and federal resources to clean up slums, to improve education, to really attack the fundamental social ills of this country was most unfortunate. I think that these sores just continued to fester, and much of the problem of the 60s was due to the lack of attention to those problems at an earlier stage in the 50s.
I think that perhaps his most important contribution in foreign policy was that he consolidated bipartisan support for the U.S. role in world affairs. He helped to bury for all time, I don't know if for all times or not, but he helped to bury for his period any Republican temptation to go back to pre-war isolationism. I think in domestic affairs that the progress that he made on some social welfare measures was constructive, and it was well that they were carried out by a conservative administration. I think his failure to deal with the recession of the late 50s, in part through Keynesian economics, his rejection of Keynesian economics, which was a mistake, and I think his failure to give his moral support to the 1954 Supreme Court decision would be perhaps the other aspect of the administration that I think reflects the least credit upon the president.
But on balance, I think you'd have to say that President Eisenhower guided our country through a very perilous period. But he did it not so much by dynamic leadership as he did by comforting us.
Some views, then, of Eisenhower the president. Let's go back a few years. What about Eisenhower the soldier, the general who commanded the largest military operation ever, yet never had battlefield experience during war? Some have said that Ike was a better administrator than strategist. I put that question to General Omar Bradley.
Well, he was good at both. He was very good at strategy. He had come out number one in his class at Leavenworth, Command General Staff School, 1926 or 7, and he knew what he was doing. Anybody in the Army that has any high position has to be a good administrator. You just have to learn to be an administrator. You hold big jobs, you got big budgets, you got a lot of people under you. But he was good at both.
Military historian Dr. Stephen Ambrose.
It depends on the time period you're talking about. In the early part of the war, he didn't do much on his own as a strategist. He provided arguments to support the position that George Marshall had taken. But it was always clear that it was Marshall's position that he was defending. In a very real sense, until 1944... his role was more in the strategic field was more that of a staff officer than an initiator. It was Marshall's ideas, Marshall's initiative, Marshall's foresight, Marshall's drive that Eisenhower supported, rather than creating a strategy of his own. This most of all applies to the question of when do you invade. When Ike became the supreme commander of the Allied Expeditionary Force, he had himself gained a lot of confidence. It's very easy to see, for me at least, a steady growth in his own self-confidence. And by the time he took over in London in January of 44, through a subtle process, but nevertheless very real one, he had become his own man in a way that he hadn't been before. He no longer followed Marshall's lead. He had some very sharp disagreements with Marshall, as a matter of fact, over strategy. He insisted on his own way. He insisted on his rights as commander to handle this operation the way he saw fit. And he took the line that the combined chiefs of staff have seen fit to entrust me with it, and it's therefore my responsibility, and it'll be my decisions. Now, as to Ike as a strategist in 44, when he was on his own, one of the dangers is one tends to... there's an almost irresistible tendency to think that what happened was the only thing that could happen. With that caveat, I think he was a brilliant strategist. The ultimate test was that it worked. You know, he won. This is somewhat like the question of who is the better general, Grant or Lee. I've always felt that the guy who won is the better general.
I always thought that Eisenhower was a lot brighter and a lot more knowledgeable than the intellectuals, his intellectual critics, were prepared to concede. Now, he was no great creative brain, and no doubt about that. But he could think, and he had a logical, coherent mind, and he was a sharp prober. And I think the new military biographies that are being written about Ike now tend to put his intellectual competence more in perspective.
He was very good at the kind of job he had in Europe, really. The particular job he had in Europe was to create the Supreme Headquarters of the Allied Expeditionary Force, SHAEF. This required a certain kind of genius. He could use his personality as a sort of a medium of communication to fuse things together so that people who might otherwise have been fighting were working together. And this, I give him all credit for it. This was an important thing to do in history, and he did it.
Was that his most important contribution?
I think so.
It's a common wisdom, which is that he was the only guy who could make the alliance work in practice, is, I think, probably right in this case. Eisenhower spent an enormous amount of his time mollifying other important people. Mollifying in the sense, or anything else, of making sure they knew that he was taking their views into consideration when he made a decision, and that he had heard them out fully. This required, and it's not a characteristic that Eisenhower is usually given credit for having, but which he had in abundance, it required an enormous fund of patience. He would literally argue with Churchill for 10 hours at a time, allowing Churchill to have his full say, to use every gimmick that Churchill could think of to try and get him to change his mind, and so on. But listening, and listening carefully, paying attention. He could move from that kind of a discussion, sometimes in the same day, very often the next day, to a five-hour rap with de Gaulle, in which he had to hear de Gaulle through, to which he might have to go to a conference with Patton. Following the next day might be a conference with Montgomery. One little incident, Montgomery always refused to go to SHAEF headquarters, so whenever Ike wanted to see Montgomery, he had to go to visit Montgomery at his headquarters. Eisenhower had enough, I don't know what the word would be, humility? Self-confidence in himself so that he didn't need to stand on the prerogatives of his office. Whatever it was, Eisenhower would go see Montgomery. He would hear Montgomery through and then make his decision. Very seldom did Ike have his mind changed in these things, but I don't know of a single instance in which he sent someone away in which that person didn't feel like, all right, I've made my full case the best that I can, and the guy really listened to me. That was the ability more than the grin, which of course helped, more than the optimism, which of course helped. That was the quality, it seems to me, that made him a success as the Supreme Allied Commander.
General Ike's wartime aide, Harry Butcher.
I think probably, assuming a man has the kind of personal qualities that makes him get on with various types of persons and of nationality, that's a prerequisite. And General Ike had that in a big smile, and he was courteous, and he was frank, and he sort of generated a feeling of integrity. His personality helped him a great deal in exercising his military function, because he was able to get along with people so well. He was well-rounded, and probably that was a great quality that made him a success as an Allied commander.
Ike's wartime public relations officer, Thor Smith.
You've heard a lot of the anecdotes about Ike and making people work together. I mean, he had the knock two heads together. If they didn't work together, they both get canned, that type of thing. When I came back from the war, I was given a lot more credit than I deserve because I had been his public relations officer during those critical days. And they say, my gosh, what a terrific job you did. You know, he's going to end up being president and whatnot. I said, I didn't have anything to do with that. It was just it was a great product to sell.
Which brings us to the question most everyone asks about Dwight Eisenhower. What was he really like? On that, even his detractors agree.
I thought he was a great guy. Everybody did. He was very charming and locker room type a little bit. But he's the kind of fellow you like to be outdoors with and do things with.
Eisenhower, I always felt, above everything else, was a great human being. And his integrity and his decency emerged in all of our personal relationships.
He was just a nice companion who had human thoughts and pleasant to be with. And I think this is the... I don't think there was a mean bone in his body, really. I think this is the impression the American public have of him. At least it's mine.
When I came back, then and for years thereafter, when anybody found out that I had been one of Ike's personal staff, they said, well, what's he really like? I said, well, he's just the greatest ever. I said, I don't think the world has too big a job to give him. And this is a long time before he had done the NATO job or Columbia or the presidency. And that's the way I felt about it. He was big enough to cope with the world's biggest jobs and the biggest world's biggest problems.
Well, when I interviewed him, it was in the mid-60s. He was very old by that time, physically. Mentally, he was quick and bright, very sharp memory. The thing that stood out most was his humanness. He was extraordinarily relaxed, but more than that, and this is part of what I was just talking about, he had that ability to attune to you and to become interested in your problems, and a willingness and eagerness even to help you with your problems, so that he established an atmosphere in his office as soon as you walked in of trust and openness, relaxed, and you immediately got down to business. He was as helpful as he could be. You had no feeling, I at least did not, and other people who have interviewed him have said the same thing, you had no feeling at all of a standing on ceremony or that this was an ex-president of the United States. Here was a guy who knew a lot of stuff who was really eager to share it with you, kind of an atmosphere. This applied, however, I found later, more to discussions that revolved around World War II than discussions about post-war events and especially political events during his presidency. I was frequently surprised when I'd ask him questions about either his presidency or the time when he was chief of staff of the Army from 46 to 48. His memory wasn't good. And yet he could remember the names of all of his division commanders and could tell you where each division was and could really get into those kind of problems and remember them as if they happened yesterday. An example of this, and one that sums up interviewing Eisenhower for me, came when we were discussing one day the Battle of Casterin Pass. And we had some maps spread out on his desk, kind of pored over them, and we spilled some coffee on them. And I had been working on this for about a year, so I knew a lot of the details, you know, and I could jog his memory, and he could supply stuff that I, of course, didn't know. There was a real flow of information going back and forth. In the process, his coat came off, and he rolled up his shirt sleeves, and eventually his feet got up on his desk. And his language was very much of the barracks room, which was fairly typical of him. He used a lot of Anglo-Saxon phrases. He had, after all, spent 30 years in the regular army, and it was inevitable that he would. After about 2.5, maybe 3 hours of this, his secretary walked in and said that the editors from Doubleday were there. Now, he was writing his presidential memoirs at the time, and the editors had come to talk to him about those presidential memoirs. and he asked me to stick around to meet them, so I was kind of gathering up my notes and getting the map off the desk, and out of the corner of my eye I noticed that his shirt sleeves had come down, and he buttoned them. He put on his coat, and he sat up stiffly at the desk. The Doubleday editors came in, and I suddenly realized that before my eyes I had seen a transformation from a three-star general in the mud of North Africa in the spring of 1943 to the President of the United States. And the language, it was immediately apparent that he had switched from being a general to being the president. The sentences were no longer complete sentences. The context was getting garbled in the same way that it used to in the press interviews. All of the curse words had disappeared from the vocabulary. He was very stiff and very ill at ease. It was just fascinating transformation right in front of my eyes.
Oh, he's just the very best. He's so tremendously friendly, human, warm. He was the best.
I'd like to close this series, if I may, on a personal note, to mention some of the scores of people instrumental in its creation, some of the people who took time, a good bit of it considerable time, to talk with me about Dwight Eisenhower.
Sometimes we'd play two or three rubbers of bridge and we'd sit there and talk.
General of the Army Omar Bradley, one of Ike's closest friends. General Bradley lives in Beverly Hills, California now. He's chairman of the board of the Bulova Watch Company, remains active, swimming and playing golf. And a special note of thanks to his former aide, Colonel Huddleston, for his assistance to me.
The British have a word for an aide. They call an aide a dog's body, something always underfoot and easy to kick around.
Harry Butcher was Ike's aide during the war, but much more than that, a close and valued friend upon whom Ike relied to give him frank opinions. Harry Butcher lives now in Santa Barbara, California. He wrote a book on his wartime experience with Ike, started radio and television stations on the West Coast, now has interests in cable television on the West Coast.
Even later, after he was in the White House, why, he invited me down to one of his stag dinners.
Ike's wartime public relations officer, Thor Smith, now lives in an apartment overlooking the bay in San Francisco. He is vice president of Mills College in Oakland.
And we sat in this air raid shelter, and he told me about the strategy of war. There wasn't really anything.
Kenneth S. Davis has a fistful of books to his credit, including biographies of Eisenhower, Stevenson, and Lindbergh. He's a frequent writer for periodicals, is completing a biography on Franklin D. Roosevelt to be published by G.P. Putnam Sons.
The Germans have been able, given the progress they are making with the V weapons.
Dr. Stephen Ambrose holds the Eisenhower Chair of Military History at Kansas State University. He has six books to his credit, including the current Supreme Commander, War Years of General Dwight Eisenhower, published by Doubleday. There are others to thank. Senator and former Vice President Hubert Humphrey. Columnist Roscoe Drummond. Former Secretary of Health, Education, and Welfare Arthur Fleming. A special note of thanks to Gail Kubik, who graciously wrote the music for the series, and to the Kansas State University Chamber Symphony for recording it. A big note of thanks to Dr. John Wickman and his staff at the Eisenhower Library, and especially to Willie Scott, who labored over the tapes and film tracks for us. And finally, a hope that the series has provided some insight into the life of Dwight Eisenhower. If we have accomplished that, the series is a success.
The Eisenhower Years was produced by Extension Radio Television at Kansas State University on a grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. The producer-narrator was Ralph Titus. Research by Anne Frank. Music for The Eisenhower Years was written by Gail Kubik, performed by the Kansas State University Chamber Symphony, conducted by Luther Levengood. Our thanks to the staff of the Eisenhower Presidential Library for their assistance in producing this series of broadcasts. This is Paul DeWeese. This is the National Educational Radio Network.